From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues every week from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in our lives between body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? How long are you willing to keep staying stuck in your own patterns of fear and avoidance and denial and keep your life limited? So on this show, we try and help you learn a few things that will free that up and get you through your fear and start living more fully. Now, first I want to start off by wishing everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and I hope that you had a great day and that your weekend continues to be wonderful. Today on the show, we're going to honor the fact that December 1st is World AIDS Day. And if you've listened to my show over the years, you know that around this time, as well as other times through the year, I always do some show related to HIV and AIDS in terms of an update. I've dealt with mental health issues in HIV and various communities and the issue of infection and spread. And since it's World AIDS Day, we're going to be kind of taking a look back on a quarter century of what's been going on with HIV and AIDS. And in a few minutes, I'll be introducing my guest, Dr. Mark Katz, who wrote a editorial in NLA Magazine titled Reflections on a Quarter Century of Progress and Blame. But I'd really like to start by dedicating today's show to a friend of mine who would have turned 46 today. Today would have been his birthday. His name is David Mann, and he passed away on May 14th, 1994, literally in the hospital in my arms after a long illness and a three-week coma that he went into, and it was a result of complications from his HIV. And it was quite one of those sad but miraculous experiences that a lot of people who have been at the bedside of loved ones often report. Whether it has to do with HIV or other illnesses, there is often that sense of sadness, but some kind of light-filled experience. And so as the tape player was playing The Light Has Come, a chant from Louise Hay's Hayride, David just took his last breath while I was holding him and stroking his hair. And so I dedicate today's show to my good friend David Mann and all the others that in the course of my lifetime have passed from HIV and AIDS, as well as those all over the world still living with it. So I'd like to start actually by talking about my own journey. You know, as a gay man, it was one of those terrifying things back in the mid-80s when I was still living in Florida and people were talking about this new gay cancer and, you know, something strange happening within the gay community. And when they finally identified it, I really expected myself to be having to write my will immediately and, you know, deal with my own death. And I was one of the lucky ones that grew up in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s when we didn't know about HIV and AIDS, and the lucky ones that was not infected, and saw that in the course of that, as I moved to LA in 86, that my life really became, my professional life as well as my personal life, really became about being part of the support system of HIV and AIDS here in the Los Angeles area as well as around the world. And without going into too much more about that, I really want to get right into introducing my guest. And as I said, he is Dr. Mark Katz. And Mark is somebody that I'm proud to say I have known since 1972. And when he was still in medical school in Syracuse at Upstate Medical Center. And he actually lives in L.A. like I do and moved here before I did, in fact, years before. And not only is he a incredible internist with Kaiser Permanente, but he professionally as well as personally has dedicated his life since 1985 to being part of the support structure also of people living with HIV and AIDS and those dying. And he's been on a personal level a volunteer for many organizations, particularly LA Shanti Foundation, Being Alive, Los Angeles Jewish AIDS Services, and he's on many advisory boards, including AIDS Service Center of Pasadena, and has received many acknowledgments and many awards over the many years he's been doing this work. But in particular, I know Mark as a very genuine and very humble individual who does a lot of his work quietly and does it totally from the heart. And he's one of those physicians that you know you're going to be getting a lot of truth and a lot of warmth from. So without taking any more time, I'd like to introduce all of you to Dr. Mark Katz. Mark, you there?
Yes. Thank you, Stuart. Thank you for that very warm and sweet introduction. It's nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Is there anything else about you that I didn't say that you want to make sure that the people listening know about?
No, just that any opportunity that I can have to speak about HIV and the epidemic and reflect and educate is an honor and a privilege for me, so I'm ready to roll.
Okay. Now, before we even get into it, I want to remind my listeners that this is a live show, and if you want to call in with a question for myself or Dr. Katz, or if you have a comment and you just want to participate in the discussion a little bit, in the Phoenix area, the phone number is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, as I know a number of you are, because I get emails from you occasionally, including last week I got a couple, from outside the Phoenix area, it's the same number. It's area code 480-949-1310, as in 1310 KXAM. Now, Mark, I mentioned at the beginning, you okay if I call you Mark instead of Dr. Katz on the show?
Please, please do. You especially,
I've known
Stuart.
You too long to do anything else.
Right, right.
You wrote this editorial in NLA Magazine called Reflections on a Quarter Century of Progress and Blame. So I really want to talk about, number one, your journey in the last quarter of a century, and then talk about what is the current situation with HIV and AIDS that we're dealing with here in the U.S. as well as around the world. So talk a little bit about your journey and your motivation.
Well, I moved to Los Angeles in 1985, just around the time the epidemic was really gearing up. And at the time, I was not a practicing physician for patients with HIV. And my first moment of profound inspiration, which is something that has lived with me every day for the last 20 years and is probably the one thing that I wanted to be sure to say on the show, so thank you, Stuart, for giving me the opportunity at the beginning, was becoming an emotional support volunteer for a Los Angeles Shanti Foundation, which still exists, which gives emotional support to people living with HIV and AIDS. And the facilitator of the training weekend, a man named Jerry Koash, who himself went on to die of the disease a year later, Jerry gave us an image in 1985, that weekend, that has stayed with me in my heart every day since. And he basically said, "The life of somebody with AIDS is a dark life indeed. And sometimes when we want to help people with AIDS, we imagine that if they're sitting in a dark room, we can run in and flick a light switch, and all of a sudden the room is floodlit with lots of light." And Jerry said, "Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way." And he said, "I think of it more as a person with AIDS sitting in a dark room, and if I can walk in there and light the first candle, just be that first moment of illumination, I've done my job.
Wow.
And so because of that, I've been able over the years to realize that I've not been the person to find a cure for HIV. No one has yet. I can't make everybody with HIV better. But every day I try to do something, whether it's taking care of a patient, educating myself, being an activist, and that image just, in a way, it took all the pressure off me.
Right.
Just a little bit goes a long way.
And a lot of people resist volunteering and stuff because they feel they can't, they won't be able to help in a big way. And what you're really saying, I think, is very important, that a simple phone call or stuffing envelopes for an organization or delivering a meal to somebody who's homebound, whether it's HIV or anything else, you know, those little things really become big things in the life of someone who's in a lot of terror and a lot of fear about their situation.
Exactly. And even, Stuart, when you mentioned David's name a few minutes ago, I knew David as well, but not as well as you. And one of the things about the epidemic that I try to do, that you do as well, is just keep saying the names again and again. We have the whole Beautiful Names Project quilt. When I do my swimming for exercise, I say to myself the names of people who've died from AIDS. It's just a silent way that I honor them. So that takes virtually no time, no money, no stress, and I feel in a very humble way like I'm doing something.
Right. I want to take something you said just a minute ago about the candles, lighting that one candle, because something that I'm sure you're in touch with, as and I know that I'm very in touch with, is there's a reverse to that too. Because what I have experienced over the years is being in the presence, especially in the 80s and the 90s, but it's still, I think, true, being in the presence of someone who's dealing with HIV and AIDS in terms of their own infection in particular, has been, on my own path and my own journey, one of those things that has lit candles in my own life and woke me up to my own sense of passion for life and mortality and humility in so many ways, that has really centered me and also encouraged me to do as much as I can step by step. So that lighting of the candle, I think, goes both ways, don't you think?
Yes, I think that's a really beautiful image you bring up. You know, I've never, I've, for all the people that I know who have succumbed to HIV, I have to say the outpouring of compassion on the part of the people helping to serve them, and even the people with AIDS themselves, I and many other people have said so many times, this actually comes from Madonna, who said it first, the people with AIDS, they're the real heroes of this epidemic. Just watching the grace, the compassion, the humility. And you know, I've never heard one patient or one friend or one acquaintance living and dying with this disease say, gee, I wish I had lived my life over differently. There's just a phenomenal sense of acceptance that comes with, if you will, a dreadful condition. And that's one of the things about the last 25 years that just overwhelmed me, how this has happened.
Well, I think, though, it's important to state that while I know we have both experienced that miraculous energy when somebody in our presence has come to that place of acceptance, that usually their journey, no matter what they're struggling with, becomes, in a sense, more centered and smoother, even when they're challenged with major illness and on their deathbed even. Even their death becomes something more light-filled, like David Mann and so many others. But when people continue to struggle and be angry and, you know, don't get to that place of acceptance, and this is true of any diagnosis, really, then that whole illness usually becomes much more of a rocky road, a lot of struggle, and very often the death, if they get to that point, their deathbed experience also becomes one of so much more struggle and so much more pain and suffering.
It certainly can be. My impression, though, is in dealing with this epidemic is that a greater proportion of people than people I've seen succumb to cancer, heart disease, other conditions, seem to come to that place if not acceptance, at least there's some a greater outpouring of compassion, I guess, is what I want to say. And there have been actual studies in the medical literature that show, for example, in reviewing 21 men with pneumocystis pneumonia in the early mid-1980s when the epidemic was gearing up, and comparing half who died with half who lived, some psychoneuroimmunologists found with statistical significance that those men who found a greater sense of what's called hardiness, three elements, control, commitment, and challenge comprise hardiness, were statistically significantly more likely to live as compared to those who died.
Mm-hmm.
So there's benefits, if you will, for doing the work that so many people with HIV have valiantly done in our country.
Right. Well, let's talk about our country, because I want to, like I said at the introduction, I want to talk about what's going on in America, but in recent years, the consciousness of what's going on in the world with this for Americans has finally awakened. So let's start with what's going on in the U.S. What is, I know that we recently probably passed the 1 millionth mark in terms of Americans diagnosed with AIDS, and that we know that this has spread the populations beyond men who have sex with men in the gay community. What is happening here and, you know, today, and how does that compare with what was happening in the 80s and 90s in this country?
Well, sure. The early years of the epidemic, of course, it was mostly a disease of gay and bisexual men, predominantly white, predominantly highly educated, although from the very beginning of the epidemic, women, persons disenfranchised from the healthcare system, children, injection drug users, of course, were all being affected as well. Today, the epidemic has quite a different face, although the predominance of cases are still in gay and bisexual men, and there are believed to be about 1 million people in this country living with HIV. And just to clarify and enhance what you just said, Stuart, there are probably have been, although the CDC has not released the data yet, more than 1 million people diagnosed with AIDS. AIDS is different, although related to HIV infection. You can have HIV infection, you have the virus in your body, but you may not have reached that point of later stage HIV, which is known as AIDS. So today there are probably 1 million Americans living with HIV. There's a disproportionate number of African Americans, and although there was some data released last week, which some people might have read, that the rate of new infections in African Americans has decreased, which is good news, there's still a disproportionate preponderance of HIV in African Americans.
Well, actually, the statistic that I got from the CDC out of FAB is the proportion of HIV diagnoses attributed to heterosexual exposure varied considerably by race, from a low of 6% among whites to a high of 25% among blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite a discrepancy.
Right. Another piece of data which just was released, which says a lot about the state of the epidemic in this country today, there's a national HIV behavioral surveillance system, and they are doing a study of young MSM, men who have sex with men. And in this testing phase, they found 25% of these men infected with HIV. These are 18 to 27-year-old gay and bisexual men in about 5 American cities. But the amazing thing is that 48% of those who tested positive through this study were unaware of their infection.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that people are still becoming infected, particularly, you know, in youth, and that they are not getting tested and that they are unaware of their infection is pretty staggering nowadays.
Well, plus the fact it's very often the people who are unaware of their infection that are most likely to be passing it on, wouldn't you think?
Right. Absolutely.
Because they are under the misnomer that they're probably negative. They may not have, you know, consciously, even without crystal meth or something, they may be choosing to have, you know, unprotected sex. And my understanding from things that I've read, and correct me if I'm wrong, is It's people who may be newly infected and may not know, usually are at most risk of passing it on because the virus is more active. Is that correct?
Yes. Shortly after infection, for the first few weeks to months, the viral level is highest, and the immune system actually does do a job after the first few weeks to months of trying to contain it. You know, what you say, Stuart, reminds me, since I know you have a metaphysical bent to the show, or a psychological bent for sure.
Well, both.
Both. In the earlier days of the epidemic, people with HIV in the 1980s were people who acquired it during part of their, if you will, normal lives, whether it be injection drug use, sex. They didn't know, because we didn't know, you know, the epidemic probably started in the mid-late 70s, and we didn't see it until the early mid-80s. But somewhere in the 1990s, this shifted a little bit, because at that point, everyone, including an American high school student with an IQ of 100, knew that you could get HIV from unprotected sex or sharing needles.
Mm-hmm.
And so people infected in the 90s and up to today have this additional element of a very important word in psychology and therapy, shame. Because these are people, and I've had people come to me, I've had HIV educators in the city of Los Angeles, people prominent in the HIV arena who've spent their lives educating people about HIV prevention, come to me and say, I've just become HIV infected.
Mm-hmm.
So just consider for a moment, you know, as a therapist, the burden, what that must mean in terms of helping that person deal with the fact, I didn't just get HIV, I got HIV when I knew darn well how to not get it, and
right.
I slipped.
Now, let's talk about, I mean, I know a lot of what we're already talking about, and this was a problem early on, is that most of the focus in the conversations were about gay men or men who have sex with men. And yet, in our country today, we've talked about the numbers of African Americans in terms of infection, and a large percentage of that are women whose boyfriends or husbands or sex partners may be either intravenous drug users or having sex with men that they don't know about. So there's a significantly large number of African American women getting infected, but there's also a large population of teenagers who think that this is not something they need to deal with or worry about. And so we have increasing numbers, as I understand, among adolescents at the same time as we have resistance to sex education and AIDS education other than abstinence going on in this country. Am I correct in that statement?
Absolutely. And just to tangent onto one of many political things we could and would say about the epidemic is that in 2002, the Bush administration removed condom fact sheets from the Programs That Work section of the HHS website. So clearly there are some political reasons and some overlay. But along with that, you've got the impetuosity of youth, the fact that, you know, young people don't see a cigarette and see lung cancer. But I think you touch upon another very important issue, and the paradox, one of the paradoxes of the epidemic, which I live with every day in the people that I take care of, is that we have, to some extent, in this country, turned AIDS into, the famous words, a chronic manageable condition.
Mm-hmm.
People are not succumbing to the epidemic the way they did prior to 1996, when we finally developed potent medications.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually was a subset of the same young men study I alluded to a few minutes ago, which a couple of years ago interviewed young men who were at high risk for HIV, and the preponderant perception was, oh, if I get it, I'll just take a pill.
Right.
And it
is an American mindset anyway about anything.
About anything, that's exactly right. So the mindset in youth of today is, you know, the good news is that, hey, if I get HIV, I'm probably not going to die. And you know something? We tell people newly diagnosed with HIV today who come to the clinic for the first time to see me, I can actually tell them with medical backing that, you know, there's a good chance you should live a normal lifespan if you
mm-hmm.
if you get trapped and you take your medications. So this in itself has sort of backfired upon us.
Well, but even in your editorial, you quote your friend Victor saying, but it's not exactly diabetes or arthritis, because the medications that people take are still handfuls, and the side effects of those medications. I mean, I have a really close friend in Florida who has been diagnosed since I think around 1990, and you know, he's married, and his challenge recently has been that his pancreas is giving him a lot of problems, and it's not HIV, it's the side effects from the meds. So people don't get that, yeah, there are pills available for this, but in some cases, not all, because in a lot of cases these medications are really helping people, but in some cases it's causing additional problems and actually a breakdown of people's immune systems and certain organs.
Exactly. And, you know, to carry that further, with diabetes and arthritis, it doesn't change your sexualizing for the rest of your life. You don't have a condition you can transmit to someone else. I mean, there's no way that it is like diabetes or arthritis, but we have made phenomenal strides in helping people live longer compared to a quarter of a century ago, where the median survival time with AIDS was about 6 months.
And the truth is, people are still dying in this country from HIV-related complications.
Absolutely. And
you
I know you're going to get to the
and,
world in a few minutes, and there the story is dismal.
Okay, then let's get into what's going on worldwide. And I have a quote from Reuters. Almost 5 million people were infected by HIV globally in 2005, the highest jump since the first reported cases in 1981, and taking the number living with the virus to a record 40.3 million, the United Nations said on Monday. 5 million new infections, 40.3 million living with the virus worldwide, and it's growing tremendously. What's going on there?
Well, actually, let me just add another way of to the listeners. Since we started this show, there have been several hundred people newly infected with HIV in the world. It happens about 7 times a minute. And 3 people per minute die. So almost 100 people have died from AIDS complications.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the part that gets anguishing. This is the thing that keeps me up late at night. How it will look one day when we have enough perspective that there is this epidemic that we had effective treatment for. And yet, majority of people in the world, and we're talking more than 90% of the people in the world, don't have access to this medication. And no matter how much the global UN fund on AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis has been working, no matter how much strident activism there's been on the part of individuals, pharmaceutical companies, the bottom line is that a majority of people living in the world, given that 25 million of those 40 million people live in sub-Saharan Africa, simply don't have access to medications, and that's the call it genocide, call it denial. I cannot find the words to wrap my conscience around what's happening in the world and how the number of people that are dying with a disease that we have treatment for.
Well, let's go back even to the 80s and. The UN and the U.S. and people all around the world knew what was happening in Africa long before things hit Western Europe and the U.S., you know, and people chose, well, you know, it was, to me, a very racist thing, but people chose not to address it. It was just, you know, those blacks in Africa who were getting sick and dying and, you know, we don't need to worry about it. And it wasn't until it hit here and in Western Europe that people started dealing with it, even though it was primarily the gay community and governments were still resistant because, well, it was just those gay men. We don't have to worry about that because who cares if they die. But the attitude about sub-Saharan Africa for many years, even before it started spreading outside there, people knew about it. People knew something was going on there. And nobody chose to help. Now it's politically correct and certainly looking great if you're taking up the cause of what's going on in Africa and Asia and the former Soviet Union.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, you know, there is, you know, in your article, in your title, it says quarter century of progress and blame. And I think one of the things that people are just, you know, need to at least acknowledge is the fact that what's going on in Africa is not new. It's just that it's new that people are finally paying attention to it, don't you think?
Sure, sure. Absolutely. This, the politics and the humanity or lack thereof tied in with the epidemic is phenomenal. like you say, how we have blamed, we blamed Africans actually for importing and exporting the disease, and then we blamed gay men for transmitting it, particularly the flight attendant Gaetan Duga, who was called Patient Zero. What a title to go through history with, and he of course succumbed to the disease. But this has been all about blame. There's racism, there's sexism, there's elitism, that every negative ism that you could describe, even elderly people with HIV in our country feel disenfranchised because people don't look at them as, oh, you can't have HIV, you're 78 years old. This disease, unlike any other condition I've ever dealt with in my medical career, has the overlay with political ways of looking at people. You know, with there's hatred, there's fear, and yet I always try to say there's also compassion. But what I'm looking for are 14 million families to take in the 14 million AIDS orphans who live in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
I also would like to add a statistic, just for those of you listening who like statistics, if you want something to kind of wrap your mind around and speak at the next coffee house or cocktail party. In 2004, the number of babies born with HIV in the United States was under 100. I think the number was 58 or maybe 70, but a two-digit number. Thanks to pregnant women being screened for HIV, being placed on treatment if they have HIV, under 100 babies in the United States. The number of babies born in sub-Saharan Africa that same year with HIV, 560,000.
Wow.
Talk about a disparity, a condition that's preventable. How can this globe, how can we as humanity live with ourselves when this is going on? And I feel a part of it too. I'm not putting it out there that all of you should be doing something. This is where I get back to the light bulb in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I try to do whatever I can.
Well, you know, all of us can't do everything everywhere, and you know, whatever we can do, we you know, need to look in our hearts and do within our own sphere. Whether it's writing a check or spending some time volunteering somewhere, you know, we do what we can do. Back in the early 90s, for the very reason that there was nobody addressing it, that's if you remember, I formed this nonprofit called the International AIDS Project and started taking groups of people over to Russia and the former Soviet Union to start doing education and prevention work, but to truly do some prevention work because there wasn't an epidemic there yet because the borders were so closed. But we knew that there were more Westerners going in, and it was very easy to assume that with the flow of commerce and tourism and what have you, that they will be faced with an epidemic, and nobody would listen. I mean, I even had Helena Gale from USAID tell me at the Berlin AIDS conference that we shouldn't be doing what we were doing.
Yeah.
She later came up and apologized to me because she knew she, you know, shouldn't have said something like that. And my response to her was, well, if not us, who, basically, because the U.S. government isn't doing anything in the former Soviet Union, and now the epidemic rate over there, primarily because of intravenous drug use growing so much, is as big as it's been in other countries, and it's not just now Russia and all the other former Soviet satellites and stuff. It's just growing tremendously in a country that most people don't realize in terms of medical care and conditions. When I was there, at least in the early 90s, felt almost more like a third world country than a Western country.
Right.
You know, so people need to do what you can do, and don't let anybody tell you it can't be done.
That's right. That's
you
right.
Know? So let's talk about good news. What's the good news in the world right now around a quarter century? You know, what progress has been made, and what's some of the good news we're looking at here as well as worldwide?
Well, I think I could condense that into, you know, actually since I have a slide I use in my lectures, which exactly summarizes my perception of the good news. And first of all, we've developed potent antiretroviral drugs which can suppress the virus in most everyone who needs them, who takes them, and frankly, prevent them from dying. And there have actually been some studies out of Johns Hopkins which calculated and actually found the survival benefits of AIDS therapy in the United States, that we've saved 2 million years of life if we add up all the people with HIV and the interventions which they received. So we've developed potent regimens. We've really turned the tide of the epidemic in babies, as I just alluded to a few minutes ago, you know, with fewer than 100 babies being born in the United States. We've invoked compassion, and I'll call it compassionate activism. We've got physicians who used to go before the FDA. You know, people are doing the best they can do in many ways. There is not an AIDS unit in the United States in any hospital that I'm aware of. And I can remember in Los Angeles, as simultaneously in the late 80s, early 90s, there were seven. There was a statistic that was released in the late 80s, which some of you may remember, which predicted that by 2000, 50% of the hospital beds in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco would be occupied by people with HIV. And frankly, in 2000, in those three cities, it was hard to find anybody in the hospital with HIV.
Well, so I remember when I first moved to L.A. in 86, the first job that I got was to help open one of the first AIDS units at West Covina Hospital,
oh,
which was
right.
Simply a six-bed unit that was dedicated because it was a very small hospital. And I remember what we had to go through back then to find nurses from the hospital willing to volunteer for that particular unit, and the in-service we had to do for the maintenance crew, for the doctors. And the odd thing was, it was the doctors that used the hospital that were the most resistant to participating in working at the union, other than Dr. James Lee, who was starting the whole thing. It was amazing to have Debbie Alexander, a nurse, come up and say she's willing to do this. And she was one of those really courageous nurses early on that said, you know, somebody has to do this, and I want to be a part of it.
Right,
but
right.
Getting those units open initially were very difficult because every hospital was afraid of community reaction.
Right.
You know, doctors pulling their patients out of the hospital. There was so much going on within the medical community about getting past this. And now, you know, like you're saying, it's like there's no problem mixing on the same floor, on the same unit, you know, HIV patients and non-HIV patients. People have one of the good news is that people have more of a sense of normalcy about this and less a sense of terror and fear about it in terms of treatment.
Right. And, you know, for you people listening or who are healthcare workers, there's a beautiful editorial written several years ago that reminded us that prior to the mid-20th century, and certainly in the 19th century, being a healthcare worker meant you might contract an illness from your patient and die, particularly tuberculosis, influenza. And thanks to sanitation, vaccination, antibiotics, we had made tremendous strides. And ironically, just around the year the AIDS epidemic was gearing up, we had eradicated smallpox from the world. So we sort of had gotten to this point in the healthcare world where, you know, we felt pretty immune, if you will, or free from the possibility of that. And AIDS once again humbles us and reminds us that it is possible, although, of course, you don't catch AIDS, HIV, easily from a patient, but certainly someone doing a procedure, getting stuck with a needle, you know, there have been few cases reported. But the principle I'm getting to here is that AIDS once again takes us away from that hubris, if you will, that nothing can ever happen to me. And thanks to people like Debbie Alexander and Jim Lee, people who said, you know, the work's got to be done. I'm going to go ahead and do it.
And you.
And you.
So, other good news?
Good news is there are more treatments afield. We are not able to eradicate the virus, but we can successfully contain it. But the not good news is 25 years into the epidemic and 20 years after the discovery of the causative organism, we don't have a vaccine. We are nowhere near having a preventative vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the global access, as we've alluded to, is abysmal, and every 20 seconds you could tick off in your mind that somebody has died from AIDS, producing AIDS orphans, producing changes in the lifespan in African nations where the average lifespan has decreased by 15 years
mm-hmm.
since the onset of the epidemic.
Let me ask you something, Mark. Do you see this in, you know, extremely high populated countries in Asia and Africa as actually reversing the increase in population in those countries?
I believe that's been discussed, and of course some of the countries like China and India, which have India probably has the most number of people with HIV living in the world, although that country puts out statistics of about 4 million, which puts it on par with South Africa in actual number. And I've had the privilege of doing some AIDS work in India. I could tell you it's probably well over 10 million or 1% of the population. To actually have it reverse the population in a place like India and China would, I believe, would take a lot more. But there are African countries where what you just said has happened. In Zimbabwe, the life expectancy for a newborn has gone from 52 years old in 1990 to 34 in 2003. And there have been mathematical models of actually, you know, reversing population growth, not to mention the emotional devastation, the fact that the people in the vital years of their lives, the workforce, and you know, there have been articles in newspapers. I have to say the Los Angeles Times does a spectacular job of covering the very touching issues, including global issues of the epidemic, and showing photographs of a funeral in a village in Africa where the last middle-aged person was being laid to rest, leaving behind grandparents and young children to carry on the duties that needed to happen. So, yes, this is part of the dismal news. And then in our own country, with all that we know about how you get and how you don't get HIV, to get statistics that show that in certain subgroups, such as gay, bisexual men and youth, that the rate of new infections is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
This, we believe, is due in part to the crystal meth epidemic and, you know, again, the invincibility of youth, other substance issues. But we know how to not get HIV, and still the rate is not just stable but increasing. And that's some of the bad news. That's a lot of bad news. That'll keep you up at night.
Right. Well, it really is. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago I had Rob Weiss on. I don't know if you know Rob.
Mm-hmm.
He just came out with the first book called Cruise Control, the first book that deals with sex addiction in gay men.
Uh-huh.
And it's really an incredible piece. And my conversation with him also included the issue of the connection with crystal meth addiction epidemic going on, and combining with sexual activity and an increase in, you know, the numbers of new infections within the gay and bisexual population in many major cities is just, you know, astounding to those of us that have lived through it. And part of the problem is, like you said, a lot of people think it's a chronic, manageable disease. A lot of people haven't had that experience of walking down Santa Monica Boulevard, seeing young guys with walkers wasting, with Kaposi spots on their faces, and, you know, things like that that really brought home on a daily basis to many of us what we were living with.
Right.
And, you know, it's that reality that a lot of the younger people don't have and don't relate to, and yet, and I've talked about this many times on the show, that the generation of mentors within the gay community were really the part that was wiped out. It was our generation,
right,
primarily, that got wiped out. So a lot of the youth don't have that next generation up as mentors in a healthy place. So there's nobody for them to use as role models, at least very few around.
Exactly. I've thought of that as well, particularly gay youth, right? The role models, the people in the active prime of their lives, are fewer in number. I mean, here are two of us, you know, privileged enough to be here speaking about it. But, yes, so many are gone.
Mm-hmm. And yet, not to minimize the fact that there are so many conscious gay youth and bisexual youth and transgender youth that are activists themselves and have really stepped up and are trying to work with their own generation as well as work within the community and learn what they can. So I don't want to minimize the fact that, you know, all of that younger generation are out there doing the partying, and the truth is there's still many in our own generation that are out there using the meth today.
Absolutely, absolutely, and hence the number of cases keeps going, and we're far from the epidemic being over. Again, 1 million people in America living with HIV.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about a website which you were telling me about earlier this morning called Aegis, www.aegis.com. And among so many other things that you do, you also are the doctor under Ask the Doctor section on that website that coordinates a panel of physicians that answers questions that people write in with that. Talk about that website and what it's for, you know, who put it together.
Sure. Aegis, which is a huge, wonderful application of the Internet, an informational service that gives state-of-the-art information about any aspect of the epidemic. You know, we started this about 3 years ago, giving people a chance to write questions in. And I have to say that we've gone through a couple of thousand questions already. There's a panel of 11 physicians, myself included. I basically sift through the questions and assign them out. And the most, not just a majority, but I would say 70 to 80% of the questions that come into the website in 2003, 2004, 2005 are the worried, probably well. I'm a married man. I had sex with a prostitute. We used a condom. I can't live with myself. Did I get HIV, et cetera? Or, you know, I ate at a restaurant and the waiter looked thin. Could I get AIDS? And what this website, I mean, the good news is that we're educating people. Mm-hmm. The sad news is that it always reflects back to me on how much people yet need to learn about this, how much fear of transmission there still is. It's possibly been swept under the rug in the last 20 years, and it may not be as socially acceptable for people to talk about it overtly, but boy, it's sure there. The phenomenal service that I think the website has done for, however, with the G in the name, Global Information Services, we get many, many solicitations, questions from people living in countries that don't have access to information like we do, people who really, really need our help. And you can read all of the postings by going to that website, group by category, to pretty much see what we've done. It also will reference and send you on to different fact sheets and conferences. As a matter of fact, the website is doing something that I'm very, very proud of, is the first international AIDS meeting was held in 1985 in Atlanta. And there was a book of the conference that very few people seem to have, and we managed to get a copy of the book from my friend, fellow activist Bill Mannion. And the Ask the Doc or the Aegis people are actually putting the entire book on the website. They're actually transcribing the abstracts. And this will be the only place in the world where you can actually view the proceedings of the first AIDS conference from 1985. So a piece of history is the point I'm trying to make.
Definitely, yeah. I know I was in Stockholm, Berlin, Amsterdam, and Montreal. Those were the four that I attended. And even then, it's just amazing to know what was being discussed then as to what the conferences must look like today, although I haven't attended one in a long time.
Right. And actually, you may remember the latest of the conferences. Berlin was 93, but Amsterdam, the 92 conference, was rescheduled, was supposed to have been held in Boston, these conferences being planned years in advance. And the organizers of the meeting, I'm so happy to say, said the United States is now a country that restricts entry into the United States, thanks to the Helms Amendment, Jesse Helms, that basically said that anybody coming into the United States could be screened for HIV, and if positive, could be denied immigration or even entry into the country for a visit. And the hypocrisy of having an AIDS meeting in this country, which, of course, many people with HIV were to attend. I'm so proud of the organizers back in 92 of saying we will not come to the United States again until this is rescinded. And guess what? It's 13 years later. There has not been an AIDS conference in the United States.
Wow, I hadn't realized that was still in place, and that was the reason why there hasn't been one in this country.
And that's why we've gone to, well, the good news is we've gone globally. We've gone to developing nations. We had Durban in 2000, Bangkok in 2004. Next August 2006 will be in Toronto. The meeting actually went from an every year to every other year from 94 to 96. We now go every other year. In even years. But yeah, it also, again, points out some of the things on the books. And you and I, of course, remember the LaRouche initiatives in California when there were, you know, motions on the ballot to potentially quarantine people living with HIV.
Right.
A disease
even
which,
under the Clinton administration that couldn't get rescinded, huh?
Excuse me?
Even under the Clinton administration, that national policy wasn't...
I'm not sure why that is, actually. That's an interesting thing, and maybe if somebody knows about it, you could let us know. But to my knowledge, it's still on the books, or maybe it's been squelched and people don't think about it. And of course, many people with HIV come into the United States, they just don't say they're HIV positive. And to my knowledge, they're not. They don't sit and test people coming in for a visit. If you were coming for, you know, permanent immigration, that might be another issue.
We have about 3 minutes left before I have to close up here and stuff. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you really want to make sure we make the point?
Well, I would just say to people listening that, you know, if you ask yourself or if you were to ask us, what can I do, I would give you these words of advice. The first thing is, take whatever steps you need to change the fluorescent overload image to the candle. You know, get into a space where you can do one thing and you've done it. And what could that thing be? First, I would encourage you, educate yourself. So the next time you hear a conversation about HIV, you hear a young person talking about being sexual without a condom, or you hear of somebody getting loaded on crystal meth, that you hear of somebody being afraid of the waiter in the restaurant because his cheeks look sunken, is be an activist, say something. And then I would say, if you want to, there are still many AIDS service organizations, likely in your local community, certainly in Phoenix, and they need people for all sorts of things. And of course, writing a check is a great way of doing something. I'm never one who said you have to spend 8 hours at a training and, you know, find your chakras and be compassionate is the only way to exercise your heart muscle with HIV. You can do a lot.
Well, one of the things that I'm reminding people is available is on my website, the archives include many shows that I've done over the last 4 years on HIV and AIDS, and I now have a search engine on the website so that you can type in AIDS or HIV, and you'll come up with a number of shows I've done, including Phoenix's Shanti organization when I did a show on mental health issues. I also had Ken Howard on the show a number of years ago talking about mental health issues and HIV. I've had Pam Yelsky on. I've had Beverly London, both women who are AIDS diagnosed. In fact, you talked about, you know, the senior citizen population. If you Mark, you would love the show because Beverly is an incredible woman, and she's a 70-year-old grandmother with HIV, and with the most incredible attitude that you ever would imagine. In fact, she went on to eHarmony.com and actually met this amazing man here in L.A. that didn't care about her HIV infection, and she's found love again at 70 with HIV. Mm. And her story is totally inspirational, and her show is archived. And I remind people also that this show with Dr. Mark Katz will be archived within the next few weeks, so that if you want to tell your friends about it so that they can listen, then it'll be there for eternity, as long as there's an internet, for people to listen to this show. So,
what a
Mark,
thought,
really,
for eternity.
I really want to thank you sincerely. I know, even though we live in the same town, we run into each other at events occasionally, but don't get to see much of each other. And this was a real joy and a real pleasure to have someone that I feel so warmly towards on the show today. So thank
back
you so
at
much.
You, Stuart. Thank you.
And I invite all of you to tune in again next week on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix, Arizona. I'll be back with another show, Tell the Truth Faster. And again, I honor my friend David Mann and all the others that have gone before and after him, and that hopefully their deaths will lead to a cure and a lot more love in the world. So thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week.